Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com. Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Hurricane Irene may be one of the top 10 most costly storms in U.S. history once all the bills are tallied. Vermont was one of the hardest hit states. Here's Governor Peter Shumlin.
It's not describable, frankly. My hometown of Brattleboro is underwater. Bennington's underwater. These are downtowns. We have no transportation system on Route 9 east to west. There isn't a road or a bridge in a state on a state highway system where somewhere we're not affected.
Former Vice President Dick Cheney is out with a new memoir, No Apologies, No Mistakes. He still supports waterboarding.
Fact is, it worked. We learned valuable information from that process, and we kept the country safe for over 7 years.
The kerfuffle over the president's job speech put White House Press Secretary Jay Carney in a tough spot.
You can never find a perfect time. There are major events that occur on television. There are, you know, other issues that you have to deal with, as well as congressional scheduling and the president's scheduling.
This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with E.J. Dionne of The Washington Post, Ben Smith, senior political reporter for Politico, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. And listeners, you can join the conversation. What's your top story this week? Will you be watching President Obama's job speech? Are you still cleaning up after Irene? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. We're joined from Washington, D.C. by E.J. Dionne, a twice-weekly columnist for The Washington Post. He's also a senior fellow at the Brookings Institute. E.J., so nice to have you with us.
Great to be with you.
And with us from New York City is Ben Smith. He's the senior political reporter for Politico. Ben, welcome to you.
Thank you for having me.
And Jack Beatty, hello.
Hello, Jane, EJ, and Ben.
We'll start with the big food fight in Washington this week over the date of the president's big job speech before a joint session of Congress. EJ, start us off. Give us the backstory. What happened?
Well, first of all, I think this is the last thing the country wanted to see. It's like arguing over the size of the table at a negotiation. And if anyone thought there would be sudden burst of bipartisanship in Washington, this blew it up.
Yeah.
There is still some dispute over exactly how this came to pass. President Obama made a request, as presidents typically do, to speak to the nation, to address Congress on Wednesday. And this happened to be the night of the Republican debate, as many of your listeners know. Speaker Boehner came back and with a letter that was kind of disingenuous. It raised all these technical problems with that night and suggested President Obama speak the next night. And eventually they worked it out that he'll speak the next day. But I think on the whole, the big question is, how can you, diss a president like this? There is no precedent for what Speaker Boehner did. But it also must be said that when you sort of look at the reporting, you wonder, did the Obama administration sort of cross all the T's and dot all the I's before they put out this public statement? Did they court this problem? And I'm still not sure of that. But I think in the end, everybody in Washington got hurt by it. Obama supporters are really mad at the Republican Congress. The pundit class says, once again, Obama gave in to Speaker Boehner.
Ben Smith, they can't agree on scheduling matters, routine scheduling matters. What does this say to you about actually getting something done?
Well, I mean, I think that's basically entirely out of the question, or pretty close. The whole exchange was, as EJ says, sort of perplexing. I mean, it didn't, and I think it, today that we quoted an anonymous White House senior aide, you know, griping that John Boehner did not, they felt that John Boehner hadn't played fair. And I think it is going to, and I think, you know, people on the right will basically see that story and laugh at them, and people on the left will just be kind of infuriated by the White House's, you know, by what a lot of, I think, Obama's supporters see as this sort of repeatedly, you know, having the ball snatched away from him as he comes in for the kick, and yet he keeps coming back and keeps sort of trusting that Republicans are in good faith.
Jack Beattie, Ben calls this exchange perplexing. How do you see it?
It's perplexing. It's also just really harmful to the president. It comes out just as a Quinnipiac poll has found he's lost 14 points since January in the dimension of, quote, does he show strong leadership qualities? He's now just barely a majority, 50. And consider the headlines that this latest flap has got. GOP forces Obama to reschedule job speech. Obama bows to Boehner. White House relents. Okay, I'll do it Thursday. Obama buckles. These are headlines that further the story, the sense that the president, not just the sense, the reality that the president has been on the ropes for months now. And really, the Republicans have been leading. He has dropped the agenda on the economy. Now he's going to try to recover it in this speech, having spent a long time just talking about deficits. Now he's going to talk about trying to get the economy moving again. Just the feeling that the president has been and continues to be overmatched. And you know, you ask why. I think Martin Wolf, who's no Bolshevik, a writer for the Financial Times, put it very well when he said, he wishes to be president of a country that does not exist. In his fantasy, U.S. politicians bury differences in bipartisan harmony. And Wolf writes this, in fact, he faces an opposition that would prefer their country to fail than their president to succeed.
Mm. So, something to that?
Yeah, EJ, go ahead.
Important point. I like that Martin Wolf piece, too. The White House is obsessed with Obama recapturing votes in the middle of the electorate, the moderates, the independents, the holy center of the American electorate. There's something to that because a Democrat cannot win with liberal votes alone. What I think they have underestimated is that center is not, it doesn't measure politicians by the number of millimeters they're away from some hypothetical political middle. They really want their president to be strong and resolute and principled. And that's why a lot of people, myself included, have been arguing that he's really got to be big and strong and clear in this upcoming job speech. My one hope out of this kerfuffle over the timing of the speech is if anyone in the White House thought that there would be ideas that could easily get through the House and the Republican blocking in the Senate on a bipartisan basis, this should tell them that they got to fight a whole lot harder and negotiate a whole lot tougher if they're going to get anything done.
Here's caller Jeff from Milton, Massachusetts, who'd like to get in on this point. Jeff, go ahead. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane. Mm-hmm. You know, I was just sort of blown away by the Democratic response after the Republicans said, Wednesday won't do. How about Thursday? Listening to your response where the Democratic representative is talking about, oh, yes, I understand it's difficult. There can be scheduling conflicts. Really disappointed with that. I was hoping instead he would say, sorry, you guys are back in town. Jobs are priority one, and we wanted to get to work immediately. And maybe leave it hanging that, well, actually what the Republicans want to do is just to continue that game.
Leave it hanging in the midst of a need for real job creation. Ben Smith, will the president go with a big idea on Thursday, or do you think he'll downsize plans to get Republican votes?
Well, I mean, I do think they're going to. Well, I mean, as EJ says, I think that this exchange kind of whatever impulse they had to go for some compromise, I mean, this probably hardened their intentions to fight, you know, to the extent that they can. I mean, but the problem is that, I mean, there may be big ideas, but there aren't going to be big sums of money in play, or not the kind of, you know, $787 billion stimulus you had a couple years ago. So, you know, they're talking about, there's, you know, a talk about an infrastructure bank which could have $10 billion of federal investment. I mean, these are real plans, kind of interesting policy plans. There's talk about it changing the way unemployment works to mirror a successful program in Georgia that pays unemployment to people who are training, for instance. These are kind of interesting, kind of Clintonian, essentially small bore, interesting ideas that could capture people's imagination, but that aren't just going to be done on a scale that they're going to be putting hundreds of thousands of people to work, you know, building roads tomorrow.
Well, today we received the new monthly jobs numbers. Here we are, Labor Day weekend. Unemployment growth ground to a halt in August. Employers added no net jobs last month, and unemployment remains unchanged at 9.1%. EJ, this is the weakest report in almost a year.
Right, and if this doesn't tell the administration that it really needs to go big, and if this doesn't tell everyone else that our eight-month obsession with debt reduction while the economy was weakening was a mistake, this ought to do it. And inside that report, there's an interesting line where they note that government employment continued to trend down over the month, minus 17,000 jobs, and that local governments have lost 550,000 jobs since September of 2008. Those losses would have been much worse without the stimulus plan, and they are getting worse as the stimulus money is disappearing. I still don't understand why the president hasn't proposed, even if it's going to get rejected in Congress, renewing aid for cops, firefighters, teachers, all these folks who are being laid off. But more generally, there are all kinds of other things that need to be done to push job creation. And this isn't just about the election. Jack and I, and probably Ben, agree that the president needs a stronger image here. But it's also, he's got to change the debate, because this is about people who are jobless. And if we don't do something to boost this economy, there are a lot of people who are going to continue to suffer. So that'll hurt him politically. But politics aside, that's a very bad thing for our country.
Jack, quick last word before the break.
I couldn't agree more. I mean, the president's got to realize he's fighting for people who need him. You know, every day that Tip O'Neill would go to battle against Ronald Reagan, his wife would stand behind him and say, "Tom, you know you're right." He did know he was right. He fought for people. People liked him for that, even if they disagreed with his ideology. The president has got to stand up for the people who elected him.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. With us today is Ben Smith, who covers national politics for Politico. Also joining us is E.J. Dionne, a columnist with The Washington Post and senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, and Jack Beatty, On Point news analyst. We just talked about the August jobs report before the break. Unemployment grinding to a halt essentially in August. Unemployment remains unchanged at 9.1%. Here's a clip from last night's CBS Evening News, where Chief Washington correspondent and host of Face the Nation, Bob Schieffer, laid out the challenge for this president with these gloomy jobs numbers.
No American president, no Republican, no Democrat has been reelected when unemployment was at this level. Ronald Reagan was elected when unemployment was just under 8%, but it had already started to go down. And that was the highest unemployment rate of any president since FDR, when a president was reelected.
Ben Smith, politically, a tough road ahead for the president.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's, you know, I mean, I think, you know, what Jack and EJ were saying before the break is true. His administration, as recently as, you know, March, there were internal conversations about how they were going to sell recovery, when they were going to be able to declare victory. And there was a whole, and they were really thinking about, well, things are getting better, and we just need to kind of convince the American people how good things are. And I think, you know, the downward turn has really taken them by surprise, and that they haven't fully adjusted to it. They don't really have an answer.
There are a flood of calls on this point. I want to get some in here. First to Nashville, Tennessee. Amber is on the line. Hi, Amber. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane.
Hello. Go ahead.
My whole thing is, being a college student or recent college graduate trying to find a job, I really wish that Obama would stand up for himself in this against Boehner. And then on top of that, on top of the standing strong, maybe put a little bit more emphasis on rebuilding infrastructure, mm-hmm. and building the infrastructure would create jobs.
So you want the president to take more initiative. I get it. Amber, thank you. Let's go to Jerry, hear his perspective from Cookeville, Tennessee. Jerry, welcome to On Point. Hello.
Hi, Jane.
Hi, go ahead.
Well, I think the speech will be pretty much a replay of last year's and the year before. I think the president needs to say that he would cut corporate taxes by 10%. I would bet money that the flow of businesses coming back to this country would be unbelievable. I heard a speech from 1962 of President John Kennedy, and it was unbelievable the stuff that President Kennedy was saying compared to today's Democratic Party. Today's Democratic Party would run him out of town and call him a Tea Party member. In fact, I mean, it would be almost, I could just imagine what Andre Carson would say to him, you know. I don't see anything coming from this.
Jerry, thank you.
I was just wondering, Jane,
yep.
I was just wondering, you guys didn't mention anything about some of the hateful rhetoric coming from the Black Congressional Caucus about when they were talking about Andre Carson saying that there's members of the Tea Party in the Congress that want to see you and me hanging from a tree. That's unbelievable for a member of Congress to say, and nobody reports on it.
Jerry, thanks for the call. Here's Andrew in Plymouth, Massachusetts. Andrew, you're on the program. Welcome. Hello.
Hi, Jane.
Hello.
I can't really vouch for the last caller there. I don't think you should be using emotion in determining policy. But especially the previous call before the last caller about infrastructure, positions, creating jobs. But you can't pay through the government to create jobs. That's creating work. It's not a job. And Tea Party members are slandered.
Andrew, I'm glad you called to join in. EJ Dion, I'll give you the last word on this. We have so many people who want to get in here. Clearly, this moment in history is striking a nerve with a lot of people.
Right. Well, first of all, just in those three calls, you saw how polarized we are.
Right.
The first caller talked about rebuilding infrastructure, and I am sympathetic to the first caller. The second caller was on the other side, cut corporate taxes, and the third caller was, it sounded like, of the same view. Two quick points. One, when President Kennedy proposed that tax cut, taxes on the very wealthy were somewhere around 70%. Somebody can correct me if I'm wrong. So we weren't talking about tax cuts from the levels they are now. We really cut taxes on the wealthy. Second, corporate tax cuts are not going to do a whole lot for us because corporations are already sitting on money. And it is simply not true that government can't create jobs, because when government spends money creating construction jobs, other kinds of jobs, that circulates money in the economy, which goes to the private sector when people buy things. And, you know, there's a whole debate about did the stimulus work or not. There is no real debate. If you look at the numbers, the stimulus at the very least created something over a million jobs, probably created something closer to 3.5 million jobs. And Kennedy was a Keynesian. He pumped money into the economy with tax cuts. Obama's stimulus, a third of that was tax cuts. So the question is, do you stimulate the economy right now or not? And I think stimulus is the right road to take, including a cut in the payroll tax and some of the infrastructure stuff that caller spoke about.
Jack Beatty, do you agree?
Oh, yes. There's no question about it. And to me, that's the puzzle of this White House. You know, the Republican campaign in 2010 was all about jobs. Where are the jobs, Mr. President? And then they changed the subject to deficit reduction. Oh, it was part of the campaign. But what I heard was jobs. And, you know, do you want... And the president didn't instead of joining the debate and saying, yes, we have to have we have to have deficit reduction. What's the way to it? A healthy, growing economy. What's the way to that? Revive economic confidence, revive the economy with what? Stimulus. And what's the example? The depression, the spending that changed the course of things for millions of Americans in the worst of our times. You know, the president's been listening to people telling him what campaigns to follow. They're pointing into 1936. 1936, the economy grew by 13% because of the stimulus. Of course, it wasn't enough to wipe away all the unemployment, but that's what Keynesian stimulus does. It doesn't create jobs. It creates economic activity. activity. The president had an argument. He dropped it. He essentially legitimated the Republican position. That's a collapse. That's an intellectual collapse. It's also a collapse of a leader. He's got a position. He's almost as if he were embarrassed by his own position.
Ben Smith, I'll give you the last word, and then we'll move on.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's right. He bought into he has been conducting his administration on the terms of the debate that were set by the midterm elections, which were this terror of government spending and real concern about government spending. A lot of Republicans thought he was going to ignore that and try to spend his way out of the recession, which they would have deplored, but might have created more jobs and lowered unemployment. And instead, he's basically agreed with them that, you know, it's worth the cost of not creating more jobs to try to get spending under control.
I just want to make a quick point that in 1936, FDR was reelected with an unemployment rate of 16.9%. But the trend, as Jack suggested, was in the right direction. When he was elected in 1932, unemployment was at 24.1%. So what President Obama needs is some movement in the right direction, and we're not getting that right now.
All right, from the president to GOP presidential politics and news this week surrounding the contents of Texas Governor Rick Perry's 2010 book called Fed Up, in which he describes, among other things, Social Security as a, quote, violent attack on American values, a Ponzi scheme. He says it was, quote, unprincipled to establish the Department of Homeland Security. Perry himself actually said, I wouldn't have written that book if I was going to run for the president. But here he is this week before the Veterans of Foreign Wars National Convention in San Antonio, Texas, saying that American troops should never serve under foreign commanders.
I do not believe that America should fall subject to a foreign policy of military adventurism. We should only risk shedding American blood and spending American treasure when our vital interests are threatened.
E.J. Dionne, quick point here. Why do you think Rick Perry is jumping seemingly so fast in the polls?
Well, because he speaks to the heart of what the Republican Party is now. It's a much more conservative party than it was even 8 years ago. And you've seen this all along, that Mitt Romney was kind of a front runner by default. He was running the strongest campaign. He had the highest name recognition. But all this thirst all year long for new candidates from Republicans. Republicans never seemed happy with the field they had. And that was not good for Mitt Romney, because he should have been the guy, the natural guy, they repaired to. Now, the hope that Romney has, but I think he's going to have to get much more aggressive about it, is that some of Governor Perry's positions are so extreme, as someone said this week, that politicians walk back statements. He may have to walk back a whole book. Even if you agree with Perry, somebody who talks the way he does about Social Security is going to have a problem being elected president. But I think Romney really needs to adjust if he is to have any chance of beating Perry. I don't think Perry will simply collapse under his own weight, but there's a lot of statements on the record there that people, including Republicans, are going to have a lot of questions about.
Here he is, former Massachusetts Governor Mitt Romney, speaking before the Veterans of Foreign Wars National Convention in San Antonio this week, lashing out against Washington establishment.
I'm a conservative businessman. I spent most of my life outside politics, dealing with real problems in the real economy. Career politicians got us into this mess, and they simply don't know how to get us out.
Ben Smith, what is Governor Romney's biggest obstacle for the primaries, do you think?
Well, the declining economic numbers we've been talking about are a huge problem for him, because a lot of Republicans who might have said, gosh, you know, I love what Rick Perry is saying, but there's no way he can win because he's so far out there on some of his views, I think are coming around to view, God, anybody could beat Obama. It sort of doesn't matter who we nominate. Obama's so weak that, you know, that we can just, you know, that we should just kind of go with our hearts. And the electability argument against Perry gets weaker as the economy gets worse. And so I think that's, you know, that's a big problem for Mitt Romney. Romney has also lately been trying to get to Perry's right, or suggesting maybe he's more conservative than Perry is on immigration, for instance. But I just think it's going to be very hard for him to do that. Just nobody is going to believe that Rick Perry is some kind of crypto-liberal.
Jack, Governor Romney
is right across the board. I couldn't agree more with what he just said.
Jack, I was just going to ask you, Governor Romney's tried to avoid the elbow throwing among his rival presidential candidates. Is he going to have to go after Perry at some point?
I would think we may see it next week in the debate. We'll all get a chance to watch without mitigation from the White House, from the president's speech, thanks to John Boehner. He'll have to do that. There's just been a deficit of love for Romney on the Republican side. There was a sort of campaign of inevitability that he was running, and those don't work. Ask Hillary Clinton.
What about Sarah Palin? She's getting ready for a big speech in Iowa. A source close to Palin told ABC News that she'll offer a full-throated defense of the Tea Party. Is this an unofficial kickoff to perhaps her own presidential campaign swing, E.J. Dionne?
I think your views on a Palin candidacy are almost like a religious question. People, there is a church that says she'll never run, and I'm in that church. And there's a church that either hopes or believes that she will run. I think she's a little late to the game now. I think Perry and Michelle Bachmann have gobbled up a lot of potential Palin votes. I think she waited too long. And I've always thought that she is more interested in her career as a writer, a speaker, and a potential kingmaker, if she can, or a queenmaker, than in running for president herself. But as I say, there's another church that dissents from that theology.
And Ben Smith, what about the other GOP hopefuls, Michelle Bachmann, John Huntsman, Ron Paul? I mean, where do they stand at this point?
Well, I do think, you know, Michelle Bachmann was riding very high a couple of weeks ago, came out, won the straw poll names, and I went to see her and Rick Perry that night in eastern Iowa. And I'm sorry, and the contrast between them was so stark, his political skills and his the story he had to tell of actually having been governor of a state for a while, really the contrast really kind of reduced her in size so much. And really, like, the whole political press corps was there. It was very, that event was closely followed by Republicans in the state and out. And she really dropped off the map about right after that night. There was just a sense that she was competing for the same votes as Perry, but wasn't quite in his league politically.
Jack Beatty?
Yeah, she's down now in a Fox poll, I've seen, to 4%, which is a plummet of, 10 points or more. And she's just been making increasingly, wild, dubious statements. I saw one this week about let's drill for oil in the Everglades. The Everglades. You know, Jeb Bush and George Bush and even Rick Scott, the governor, of Florida, they don't look upon that as a very prudent idea. So she just seems to be grasping at straws. You know, she had a moment when she had visibility after that straw poll. And if she had said sound things and come out, but instead she talked about, well, you elect me and I'll get gas prices down to $2 a gallon. And within a quarter, I'll get economic growth restored. This kind of miracle economics, people, I think, even her people that admired her begun to think, well, maybe we can get a little more traction and roughly the same positions out of Rick Perry.
E.J. Dionne, your thoughts?
Ben, they're probably right about this, but I don't quite write her off yet, at least in terms of winning in Iowa. And if she won in Iowa, she could have some strength. There are some polls that show her around 10, 12, 15%. And if some of what Perry has said begins to hurt him, because he hasn't been tested yet, really, and this debate is going to be very interesting. Michelle Bachmann did quite a job taking down Tim Pawlenty. It's going to be very interesting to see what both Mitt Romney and Michelle Bachmann do in this debate to try to drag Perry down after this surge of his.
Your final thoughts, Ben, before our break here.
Yeah, I think it's all about the debate for Perry. He's the front runner, and he's really in a position to consolidate establishment support and to walk to the nomination. And if he comes out of the debate and people say, wow, that guy really has command, he can be president, he can handle these tough questions, he's in great shape. But he's not necessarily a great debater. He's a guy who's avoided debates, avoided editorial board meetings through his career. And it's an open question whether he can talk coherently about national policy as opposed to Texas policy.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the news this week and in other news, devastating wildfires in Texas and Oklahoma. In Palo Pinto County, Texas, more than 24 homes were destroyed. Here's Sheriff Ira Mercer.
it's not far-fetched to say that we've burned half of our county off, acreage-wise.
A California Little League team wins the World Series with a walk-off game winner by 12-year-old Nick Prato.
Oh, that hit. That hit. That felt good coming off the bat. I knew it was over.
And at the U.S. Open, Serbian Novak Djokovic dominates and makes an incredible between-the-legs shot in his match against Argentinian Carlos Berlach.
He goes for the tweener, but he makes it.
But you're up 6-0, 6-0, 5-2.
Just bow down.
What a game. You can join the conversation, listeners. Does President Obama look weak by caving into Congress on the date of his big jobs speech? Will Dick Cheney's book change any hearts or minds? What do you make of Rick Perry's old book? We're speaking today with Ben Smith, the senior political reporter for Politico, E.J. Dionne, a columnist for The Washington Post and a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, and our own Jack Beatty. Let's go to former Vice President Dick Cheney's new memoir out. He spoke with Dateline NBC's Jamie Gangel this week and accused then-Secretary of State Colin Powell of undermining the Iraq War.
The portrait you paint of Colin Powell makes it sound as if he was disloyal and undermining the administration.
Well, those are your words. I don't think I say it as harshly as you have presented it. I did feel that the State Department did not serve the president well. I would hear discussions, for example, that General Powell had objected to or opposed our operations in Iraq. But that never happened sitting around the table in the National Security Council. It was the kind of thing that seemed to be said outside to others.
You felt he was going around you.
Well, not going around me, but it didn't help the cause.
And here's former Secretary of State Colin Powell appearing on CBS's Face the Nation on Sunday saying that Vice President Cheney's new book takes the low road.
Mr. Cheney has had a long and distinguished career, and I hope in his book that's what he will focus on, not these cheap shots that he's taking at me and other members of the administration who served to the best of our ability for President Bush.
E.J. Dionne, we've seen Powell and Cheney clash before. What do you make of this latest round?
Well, on the one hand, I think it took nerve for Cheney to go after Powell like that, because when they needed to make the case for the war in Iraq to the U.N., they trotted Powell out because he was the guy who had more credibility than they did in making the case for war. On the other hand, there is an interesting question that lurks under here, which is Cheney argues that Powell didn't speak up against the war strongly inside the administration. And indeed, when Powell defended himself against that charge, he said, well, I told the president, if you break it, you own it. That's a little different from telling the president, so don't break it because you don't want to own it. So I think there are some issues here. But overall, I think Powell got the better of that exchange. But that's probably entirely dependent on your bias on the Iraq war. My colleague Gene Robinson this morning at the Washington Post, a columnist, made the larger point, which is that in all of this difficult news for the president, it probably doesn't hurt to have both Dick Cheney out there in his book and President Bush out there in a National Geographic interview explaining, as his headline said, how we got here. There were decisions made in the last administration that have created some of President Obama's nightmares. And so having both of them out there reminding people that they were there before Obama is probably mildly helpful to the president.
Here's Cheney telling Politico's Mike Allen this week that critics were waiting in vain if they expected him to admit mistakes in this new book.
I'm not apologetic with respect to the policies of the Bush administration. I think we basically got it right.
But 8 years, no mistakes?
Well, I didn't say no mistakes, but I think from the standpoint of what I wanted to put down, what I knew about, what I was intimately involved in, I think we got it right.
Ben Smith, your thoughts on Cheney's book?
Well, I do think, you know, we're seeing Dick Cheney, Colin Powell, and others are these sort of world-class Washington bureaucratic infighters who were stabbing each other in the back from, like, the third day of that administration. And I think, you know, what's playing out this week is something that, I mean, this is the third or fourth kind of blow-up since the administration ended like this. But I do think it's sort of, you know, I mean, in a way, it's caused this revision of how you look at that administration, which is that there were these very powerful forces inside it who were really at each other's throats in a very bitter personal way, and you know, and are now trying to score it in their favor.
Jack Beatty, what...
Now they're stabbing each other in the front, not just...
Jack, is that how you see it?
Yeah, that seems to be what they're doing. Matt Lauer really asked an extraordinarily penetrating question to the former vice president. He said, you know, you've defended waterboarding and what the United States until then had considered torture, what most of the world considers torture. Suppose an American were taken prisoner in Iran and subjected to this technique. Where would be the moral basis of how could you possibly object to it? And Cheney, rather than joining the question, said, well, of course, an American wouldn't be doing that. That is, wouldn't be spying or wouldn't be doing anything that could get them waterboarded, which shows really just how pathetic the argument for this was. He didn't even have an answer that the military would have brought to the question they would have brought to him, which is, what about one of our people getting caught, Dick? How are we ever going to say, don't torture that guy after you have endorsed torture? He didn't have an answer for that. And that moral, that gaping hole in his whole position about torture just... He just felt like yesterday's man, just trotted out and going through the motions, but having no conviction, really, or no ability to convince in what he was saying.
Let's move on now to Hurricane Irene this week, which will likely prove to be one of the top 10 costliest catastrophes in U.S. history, between $7 and $10 billion. And much of that damage might not be covered by insurance because it was caused not by winds but by flooding, which is excluded from many standard policies. Here's some sound from Irene. She caused severe damage in places like Rockingham, Vermont, which washed away 140-year-old bridges. You can see dramatic video of this on our website, onpointradio.org. Here's some sound from 73-year-old resident Henry Shattuck this week mourning that collapse.
I've seen people crying because it's gone. So, and it hurts me, too, because, like I said, I have been over that bridge many, many times.
Jack, tell us what you've seen up there in nearby New Hampshire.
I'm just across the river from Vermont, and as many people know who travel there, the towns in Vermont are built right along the streams. The streams, I mean, at this time of the year, they usually just rills, you know, these babbling brooks, burbling, whatever the cliche is. And suddenly that inundation Sunday night hit, and then we had these floods. You know, the village of Rochester, I know it pretty well. They were cut off at both ends of Route 100. What did they do? They took an inventory of people in the town center who badly needed prescription drugs. They sent kids, teenagers, 13-year-old girls on their bikes to the next town that they could go to, and came back with the prescription drugs. Poor Rochester, the graveyard there was inundated, and all over the main street, apparently, there are remains of people who were buried 30, 40 years ago, and they're trying to figure out who they are. The village centers of Vermont are part of what makes it special, and this has really hurt them. It hurt the local economies, hurt the local stores. And now we read that Sunday night, Vermont Public Radio weather forecaster was warning there may be another tropical storm here, which we don't know what that would do. But on the one hand, one has been heartened reading about the things Vermonters are doing. On the other, your heart goes out to how stricken these communities have been.
You made mention of this, Jack. More than a dozen communities were cut off, totally cut off from the outside world. Here's Karen Dallery, who lives in the town of Killington, Vermont. She's describing the situation she sees.
We call it an island, but it's an island with no ferries and no airport, you know, so it's not really even an island. It's something more than that. There's no word for it. So fortunately, we have each other.
And here's House Majority Leader Eric Cantor insisting that any funding for disaster relief from Hurricane Irene must be offset by spending cuts in other parts of the government. He explained his thinking to Fox News on Monday.
The House has already acted and has already funded over $1 billion for additional disaster relief money. That money has been offset by savings elsewhere. Again, just like any family would operate when it's struck with disaster. It finds the money it needs to take care of a sick loved one or what have you, and then goes without trying to buy a new car or put an addition onto the house.
E.J. Dionne, what do you make of Cantor's insistence on offsetting disaster funds with spending cuts?
First of all, could I say I grew up in New England, and I think Vermont is one of the most wonderful places on the face of God's earth, and I feel terrible for all those communities that are facing that. I think what was striking about Cantor's statement is how much opposition it immediately aroused from Republicans, particularly Republican governors in states that were affected by the hurricane, notably Chris Christie, who basically said, look, they can deal with their budget. We have a real problem here, and we need the money now. Also, Governor Bob McDonnell of Virginia. And I'm reminded of one of my favorite quotations about politics, which comes from Bill Cohen, the former moderate Republican senator from Maine who served in the Clinton administration, and he said, government is the enemy until you need a friend. And I think in these circumstances, even the very conservative people in the country say, well, really, the government is the last refuge we have, particularly, for example, for all those people who aren't covered by for flooding. And so I think that either this fight will happen and it will not benefit the Republicans in the House, or they're eventually going to back off and say, all right, we're going to let this this aid through. I think it's something Obama could talk about in that speech of his, because this is money that would create jobs and help communities that have been set back economically.
Here's New Jersey Governor Chris Christie, indeed, talking in a news conference on Thursday that hurricane victims in the Garden State don't have time for bickering in Washington over how to fund disaster recovery.
We don't have time to wait for folks in Congress to figure out how they want to offset this stuff with other budget cuts. Our people are suffering now, and they need support now.
Ben Smith, how did you see all this, Christie and others managing this crisis?
Well, I did think that Christie's sort of blunt advocacy here. I saw some Republicans today grumbling that he was grandstanding, and it was striking to me how people like his shtick when they agree with him, but are less fond of his kind of blunt confrontational style when they disagree. And I think he is sort of he occupies an interesting space. He's a guy who's willing to turn on the Republicans and play to to the more moderate voters of New Jersey, and I mean that seems like that's what he's doing there. I don't think I think House Republicans get how dangerous this is, and I would be shocked if they don't, as soon as they're back in session, push this money through.
With a few minutes we have left, I want to go to Libya for a few minutes, because this week the European Union lifted sanctions on Libyan ports, its oil firms, banks, and foreign ministers met this week to discuss how to help Libya transition from four decades of Muammar Gaddafi's rule. Here he is in a 10-minute audio message released by a loyalist. Libyan TV channel aired sound of Colonel Gaddafi saying he would continue to fight and rally against his enemies.
The agents of colonialism are doomed to fail, and they will be thrown in the dustbin of history. Continue the resistance, the strong resistance, the fierce resistance towards colonialism. Tripoli should rise up and should carry on resisting the colonizers.
E.J. Dionne, how do you see Libya after Muammar Gaddafi?
Well, there's going to be a very difficult transition period. And we don't know how it's going to end up, but it's looking better now than I think a lot of people thought it would. And the policy President Obama pursued looks a whole lot better than lots of people, especially among Republicans, but also on the left, said it would turn out. And, I supported what he did at the time because I agreed with the argument that just because the United States can't intervene everywhere doesn't mean it should intervene nowhere. And I think when you were looking at what was happening potentially in Benghazi, with the Europeans taking leadership, with our troops not being put on the ground, we actually did help avert a potential slaughter of people. And I think that, and I see it now slowly, some conservative critics have started to give a little ground and say, yeah, you know, this Paul Bremer, for example, the former ambassador or the former leader of President Bush's effort in Iraq, said, you know, this worked out better than we thought it would. And good for Bremer for acknowledging that.
Ben Smith, how did the events in Libya play for the president?
You know, I mean, I think they were, I mean, the White House sees them to some degree as a vindication of this strategy that some unwise aide at some point described to the New Yorker as leading from behind. You know, and ultimately, I mean, part of the deal with that strategy is you can't go around claiming credit for the victory or getting it, and so they're not. But it was the kind of conflict that America can handle right now politically. Like, I think it probably wound up costing somewhere in the neighborhood of $1 billion, which is like less than a week in Afghanistan, and it didn't, you know, it happened kind of on the sidelines for us politically. The U.S. played a very important role, both diplomatically in terms of pushing it through the U.N. and then primarily a support role militarily. But they gladly let the French take credit.
Jack Beatty, what do you see in Libya looking forward?
Well, trouble. I mean, it's going to be a long, hard transition. But what a moment of deliverance for them. And I must say, reading Nick Kristof from Tripoli this week, as an American, I was just really proud to see those Libyans saying, thank you, America. Thank you, Obama. You saved us. We would have been slaughtered. You know, that's Nick Kristof, who's no hawk, said, you know, here is a use of military power that was consistent with human rights, that defended life, that defended all the things we want, and we get from the people, hooray! I mean, that's a good thing for the United States.
A great panel, a full hour today. E.J. Dionne joining us from Washington, D.C., columnist for The Washington Post, senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. Thanks very much, E.J. Nice to have you.
Good to be with all of you. Thanks.
All right. And Ben Smith from New York, senior political reporter for Politico. Ben, thanks to you.
Thank you.
Jack Beatty, On Point News analyst. As always, Jack, thanks.
Thanks, Jane.
Have a good weekend, everyone. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.